Let's open a work session on Senate Bill 608. Mark, you want to explain what we're looking at?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 608B modifies the provisions for payments of claims under certain insurance policies due to insolvency of the insurer. We are looking at amendments to the bill, the -12 amendments. And I don't know if you've had time to review the amendments.
Well, we'll have Cheryl and Diane, you want to come up and just give us a brief introduction, and then we'll start from there.
Okay. Mr. Chair, back to you.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Diane Rosenbaum, representing House District 14 in Portland. And I want to thank the chair and the members for taking on the task of perfecting the bill into a form that everybody will be happy with it. I have just now seen the amendments that you are looking at, and I think Representative Walker had an earlier version which is similar but not quite the same, so we're somewhat in the process, I think, of trying to compare these two without having a lot of time to do it. I guess the main thing I would say, you know, it's clear what the bill itself is trying to do, and I think now it's simply a task of crafting an amendment to this which does not exclude people that we don't intend to exclude, but still preserves the right for a conscience clause that would be crafted in a way that would get at the problem. So, what would you like us to respond to, just generally?
A general thing, and then we're going to bring legislative counsel up to explain some of these amendments.
Okay.
Representative Walker, I apologize. Do you have a clean set of the dash eights? So we
do I have any of the dash eights? I'll be looking, see if I have any of the dash eights. For the record, my name is Cheryl Walker. I'm representative from House District 51. And no, Mr. Chair, I cannot find a dash 8 in the
file. I've got a call done. Fine.
Okay, I'm sorry. I think that there must have been some kind of a bidding contest for everyone to get their amendment in. We're up to about 12 or 13 now, are we? And this is good. I think people are trying to participate in making it work. And we're waiting for Mr. Chamoff.
No, he's behind you. Did you want to make any comments?
What I'd like to comment on is the amendment that I have brought forth is the B-10 amendment, and this was to incorporate existing statute and, of course, incorporated also the Internal Revenue Code to provide for definitions of religious organizations that were already codified, that were already in use, that people understood, and that probably had withstood some court challenge at some time. And that being said, I think that it's important that we be sensitive to some of the individuals who really want to have a conscience clause in there, and I'm not opposed to that. And I know in working with all of you over the last several days, I think we all have that same view in mind. I just saw the dash 12s when I came in here. I have not actually read them. However, I do know before I came up here, an issue came up with one of the concerned parties that on line 12, in the Internal Revenue Code that is cited, it included a section A2A, and that was requested by one of the parties, and it does not in fact apply because it has to do with a dollar amount that would be applied by the Internal Revenue Service to those institutions and actually would have nothing to do with this bill. So as a suggestion, with not having really studied the dash 12s, that would have to be corrected. Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I just would concur with that. I've just been reading that language that Representative Walker was referring to, and actually if you don't know if the committee members have copies of this page in the code, and I'm sure Legislative Council will talk about it, but it does reference other kinds of charitable organizations such as those for the prevention of cruelty to children or animals that would be 501c3s, and clearly that's not what
what anybody is trying to get at here. So I think we could simply do this more narrowly as in Representative Walker's amendment. We would probably be able to pretty readily get on with this.
Thank you. Craig, how are you as well?
Does the committee have any questions of me, or I'll just wait.
Do you have time?
I certainly do. I will wait. Thank
okay.
you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Greg Chainwad, Legislative Council. With me today is Holly Robinson, Deputy Legislative Counsel. I understand that my role is to provide you with the general constitutional principles that apply to your review of Senate Bill 608, and Ms. Robinson will assist you with a discussion of the parameters of the various amendments that are in play. At the outset, I want to make clear that the law that the bill proposes is constitutional. It does not apply to any religion by its terms. It is a law of general applicability, much in the same way that the state requires of all employers that they pay unemployment compensation tax. That said, there may be fact situations outside the language of the bill that may be ones in which the constitutions do not grant the state the authority to enforce the law that the bill proposes. Those would be situations in which the law requires a person to violate a religious tenet. Sometimes the state may do that, and sometimes the state may not. And I wish I could give you some clear guidelines for when that situation occurs, but it's really, when the courts look at it, a balancing of essentially three different factors. The first is, how important is the state's mandate? How broadly does it apply? How much does it protect the entire citizenry? Second, how directly does the law require a person to violate a tenet? There would be a difference, for example, between a law that required all employers to provide their employees with pork to eat as opposed to a law that required all employers to provide employees with money with which to go purchase foods which might include pork. Those would be different levels of a direct requirement to violate a religious tenet. The third factor that the courts look at is how insular is the person or organization that's affected. A church organization that deals only through adherents of the religion and ministers only to adherents of the religion would get more protection under the Constitution than, for example, a business that deals with the entire world selling commodities and hires employees without regard to their religious affiliation. In an effort to get ready for this hearing, I reviewed all of the cases in the appellate courts in Oregon that have dealt with the state's conscience clause to find any examples where the legislature has required a person to take an action that violated a religious belief, and found only one, and that's where the state requires a parent to provide medical care to a child, and if the parent does not, the parent can be subject to criminal penalties. There was a religious objection based to that requirement, and in that case, the court held that the religious belief had to give way to the state's law. But that's the sole guidance provided by our courts on this particular issue. And I'd be pleased to answer any questions before Ms. Robinson discusses the various amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Holly Robinson. There are two sort of prevailing themes of amendments currently. I know that you have the dash B-12s in front of you. You may or may not have the B-10s.
Trying to get the dash 8s as well.
Well, yeah, I think the 8s and the 10s are related.
Let me just talk a little bit, though, about the differences in concept and the differences in approach, and so the committee can make a judgment based on sort of the approaches to it. The Dash 8s, which I think morphed into the Dash 10s, begin by attempting to define what a religious employer is. A lot of the comments that Greg made clearly allow, or in a lot of the research that we've done, clearly allow a religious employer to opt out if that's what the employer attempts to do. So by defining religious employer and however one chooses to do it, I think that there are advantages to that because it very clearly sets the playing field upon which this law is going to be applied. The descriptors used in defining the religious employer talk first primarily about individuals and how they're employed. One is that they share the tenets of the religious tenets of the entity. And the second requirement, and there's a conjunction here, is that whose employment would meet the conditions in ORS 659020. Oregon law already recognizes the ability of an employer to have a preference in hiring for someone whose religious beliefs are the same. And so what we've tried to do is parallel that in here so that if an employer who was already saying, I'm going to hire candidate X over candidate Y under these reasons, and these are state-sanctioned reasons, that under the same analysis that could be done in here as well. And the third condition of employment would be a person who agrees to work for that organization with the knowledge and with the consent that the employer that they're going to work for does not provide this coverage. Being of the age where kids go off to day camp or summer camp now, I mean, some of these camps are religiously run and some aren't, and obviously the counselors that are going to work in those summer camps are going to know ahead of time what their insurance coverage is going to be. And in this situation, the employee would, in fact, have to agree ahead of time. So that's the first set of criteria as defining your employees in a way that I think is constitutionally sound. And then the second piece is the issue of defining the organization using a descriptor from the tax code. And in the original provisions of some of the amendments, they refer specifically to little I, or little one and little three, and then the other ones don't. The committee, I think, has these words, and you'll have an opportunity to look at them. It's important in the way that we have referenced them in this draft that they are descriptors of the types of entities. And so by removing the little two, then you get down to this long list of organizations that, as Representative Rosenbaum said, includes religious organizations, educational organizations, charitable organizations. It's our belief that that would widen this bill to a point where it would be more difficult to manage, I think.
I have a question. If you use the IRS code reference,
the broad one or the narrow one?
Well, the broad one, the broader one. Why do you believe it becomes more difficult to manage?
The sub one and sub three are entities.
Unfortunately, we don't have the. I have like the summary of the. I just have like the.
That's
page
actually,
one of it. Do you have a more complete copy of the code?
Well, actually, if you look at the bottom of that page, those are actually the words. Does it say at the bottom, United States Tax Reporter 2001 on the very bottom?
Yeah, but it continues on beyond five. Five is the last thing that I have.
Okay.
And then there's an and so I assume that it continues on.
Right.
And so that's why I was...
The reason that we believe that it makes a difference is that one and three are specifically religious organizations. They're religious entities that were organized and have received their I don't want to say their tax exempt status, but in fact their tax exempt status based on the nature of their religious activities. If you take the entities that are under sub two, it's much broader than religious entities. So you go basically from religious employers, specifically within the tax code, to entities that may be much beyond a religious employer.
Just to maybe go back a little bit, I've saw a set of amendments. I don't remember which. There's so many numbered amendments now. I can't remember. But I saw kind of a control test piece,
That's contained
Mr. Castagna. What's that?
That's contained in the Dash 12s.
if you have those. Lines 8 through 10 is what I believe you're referring to on the, in the dash 12s.
And that's more of a, I'm calling the control test versus kind of what I'm viewing as maybe the religious purpose test, which is maybe more along the lines of the dash 10s, is how I'm trying to distinguish between. Is that a fair distinction? A somewhat fair distinction.
Mr. Chair, I think you'll have to explain to me what you mean by the control test.
I'm saying that a control test would be more broad. It may cover Catholic charities. It may cover other auxiliary support organizations. For example, you know, and so that's, I guess that's my question, is there's one group that's looking for a control test, I believe, meaning, but I'm not sure how the churches or other organizations are set up. I don't know. I work for a not-for-profit that we have reserve powers and all these other things. I don't believe that the many of the religious organizations are set up that way. I don't know how Catholic charities are or the hospitals. I don't know if do they qualify under this particular IRS code section, or are they going to qualify under a separate IRS code section?
Mr. Chair, that specific question I cannot answer. In answer to your earlier question, though, I believe that the language in the dash 12 regarding operations supervised or controlled by or in connection with is significantly broader. Would cover the possibility of a lot more entities than the entities that are referenced in sub 1 or sub 3 of the tax code that is how they've been defined in the B10s. There are two other just points I want to raise about the difference between the B10s and the B12s that are, I think, are important, at least for the committee's consideration. The B10s do specifically say that a religious employer may request a policy that does this, and that if requested, an insurer shall offer it. I think it's very clear in terms of, again, dealing with the provisions of the insurance code and the ability of an insurer to not offer that additional coverage. And subsection 5 deals with the issue of notice to prospective insureds. And subsection 6 is contained in the 2, and that has to do with a limitation, providing that this exclusion or that it cannot be construed to prevent the prescription of contraceptives for purposes other than those for contraceptive purposes. In some ways, I see the two sets of amendments as really two different ways of looking at the problem or situations. One's very prescriptive, attempts to define as much as possible ahead of time what the religious employer is going to be doing and who's going to be participating, and giving people notice ahead of time if they're going to be receive their insurance through this organization, what coverage they will or will not be covering. The B12s I see as being much more generic, much less subject to sort of definition or description ahead of time.
I just have another question. Who can tell? I'm interested because both of these are referencing IRS code sections. You know, I think part of my issue is with the dash 10s, they predominantly employ the individual who are of the same faith. It's a very limited approach to doing this. And I guess my question is, and maybe Mr. Castagna, who just walked, Bob, can you come up maybe? Do you mind? I'm just trying to figure out where support organizations fall in and how these things work. I just don't know. Is there someone is there someone on your staff who deals with these not-for-profit? Is Dave still dealing with some of that stuff, or? Does someone on your staff deal with? I'm just trying to figure out how these organizations are going to fall out within the IRS code. I mean, I can go back and look, I suppose, myself. But
Mr. Chair, Ted Reitlinger works with not-for-profit corporations. Dexter Johnson works with the IRS code. Both of them work pretty much in the abstract and are unlikely to know enough facts about the way that organizations work in the real world to tell you which ones will fall where.
Go ahead.
Thank you. This is a question for Holly and for Greg. Excuse me a sec, Bob. I know that in your research you've become aware of language that California has implemented in its statutory scheme as a conscience clause exception. Are you aware of any problem with the California statutory language, and how would that work if we imported it into ours?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, in the limited research I did, I did not come across anything that would indicate a problem one way or the other. There's hearsay that there may be lawsuits brought, but I did not find anything. But this terminology actually, or that actual citation, comes directly from the California statutes. But they're
Which
not
one
the
does
only.
The 12s?
The 12s, the 10s, the 8s.
All of that exactly.
All of the above.
But
in actuality, in other conscience law statutes that I looked at, they all have seemed to have followed the same model.
Thank you.
Bob, you want to...
Can I just ask...
Mr. Chair,
question?
Members of the committee, for the record, Bob Castagna, representing the Oregon Catholic Conference.
Bob, since I asked you to come, I just wanted to ask a real direct question about the scope of what you believe should be included in a religious conscience clause, because I'm trying to, in my mind, regulate that versus where the IRS code falls out, how someone gets a tax-exempt status. You know, I'm calling kind of the amendments that I saw that you proposed kind of a control test versus the other amendments that are a little more prescriptive.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I had a chance briefly within the last 24 hours, and if my recollection is correct, I think I only saw this IRS code section 6033 earlier today. And I looked at the reference in a prior set of amendments, and the 6033 sub A, sub 2, sub A is not satisfactory in our opinion. A includes sub I, and this is a reference in at least the B12 amendments, if I'm looking at that correctly. I guess there's another reference in B10, which refers to A sub 1, small Roman numerals, or sub 3, small Roman numerals. Either one of those, either the B12 reference or the B10 reference, is inadequate from our opinion. There's a listing of certain organizations in sub C in that section 6033, which is more expansive than that. I don't see a definition of integrated auxiliaries. I'm no Internal Revenue Code expert. I'm not sure what integrated auxiliaries refers to, is defined as, has been interpreted as, but we would find that to be too limited.
Mr. Chair, but can you describe for me the types of organizations that you feel should be exempted from? I'm trying to get an idea of what the scope of what the Archdiocese, at least here in Oregon, is concerned about being covered. I don't know if that includes the hospitals. I don't know if that includes auxiliary support organizations. Catholic charities. I don't even know how the Catholic Church is set up in terms of its organizational structure on how those things work.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Archdiocese of Portland, under the leadership of the Archbishop of Portland, is its own corporation. Catholic hospitals are organized separately. Catholic Charities is organized separately. There are some organizations on which the Archbishop sits as president of the board. There are some in which there is no hierarchical presence on the structure of the board. I guess I represent the Oregon Catholic Conference with two concerns with respect to this legislation and legislation generally. One, how is legislation going to impact society as a whole? An underlying common thread that we have testified in scores of bills in this and previous sessions of the Oregon legislature revolves around the Catholic Church's interest in the common good for society as a whole. A second interest that I bring as part of my representation is the interest of the Church as an entity in society. So today I appear before you wearing both hats and both concerns. We see the issue area before you as one that touches on conscience. And in an issue area that touches on conscience, freedom of religion, whether it's institutional protection of religion or whether it's the individual availing himself or herself of her rights as a believer protected by the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, that ideally both those interests would be protected, such that one's freedom of religion and the free exercise of thereof should be respected by the state, and that the interests of the majority in society should not trample on the interests and the rights and the views of the minority in society. So we come seeking a conscience clause to protect the interests not only institutionally of the Catholic Church in society, but of those in our society who seek fundamental constitutional protection for their rights and their interests. Those at times may be in tension with other people's rights, but no one should be compelled to act against their firmly held religious or ethical beliefs. And that's what we seek, a conscience clause. For those who seek to mandate prescription contraceptive coverage, they should be willing to respect the consciences and the firmly held moral and religious ethical beliefs of those who believe and feel otherwise without trampling on our rights. And that's what this debate is about in terms of seeking a conscience clause. We are not seeking to impose our views on others. We wish that our views be respected and upheld and acknowledged.
But let me ask a question in terms of, you know, this gets down to sort of the application of those beliefs. And I'm trying to weigh here in terms of we have a public policy in terms of trying to say, how do we carve out this conscience clause in terms in such a way that it applies greatly? So, I mean, you know, you start talking about the archdiocese in you know, a very, as you get closer to the church, I don't have any problem carving those out. But as we start running out, I start, you know, Providence, you know, hospital system, in terms of you employ thousands of people. Is there a responsibility of someone who is employed under that to not necessarily be Catholic, but to abide by the precepts? Is there a, could someone lose their job if they went out and did something, you know, picket against? I mean, I'm trying to understand in terms of, is it a company, you know, and you're out doing good works, versus, you know, you are furthering the religious tenets of the religion. How does the Archdiocese balance those two issues?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate your question and I appreciate your wrestling with the difficulty and the complexity of these issues, because they are truly complex. And they revolve not only upon institutions who may be employers, but they also revolve around individual employers who also have consciences. I am not here to represent the Sisters of Providence, and I am not authorized to speak for them. They do have their own representatives in the building who can speak for themselves. Sisters of Providence are a separate corporation. Catholic hospitals are separate corporations. The Archbishop does not sit on their boards. He does not exercise any voting authority in their corporate structures. But what I am here to emphasize is that, and there are other issue areas in the law, where individuals have urged their own freedom of religion and the free exercise thereof, that the United States government and the courts have respected and have acknowledged in terms of freedom of religion. And I think it's maybe unfortunate that we have to go to such lengths to urge a legislative body to recognize and to uphold in statutory language the rights of freedom of conscience of those employers. Ideally, we would ask this legislature to adopt a conscience clause that would protect all employers' rights of conscience, because any employer could, under the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, invoke their freedom of religion. And it's a question of whether or not the majority in society that seeks the language contained in 608 on prescriptive contraceptives will recognize that freedom of religion and that ability of that individual employer to invoke the First Amendment of the United States and not be compelled to pay for a service in health insurance coverage to which that individual employer objects in conscience. That's what this issue is fundamentally about. And there's a certain element of this debate which unfortunately has the feel of a push. It is a mandated prescriptive coverage which the amendment seeks. And there's a certain element of this which offends to the extent that it would violate one's freedom of conscience and free exercise of religion. I understand where the proponents of the legislation are coming from, and we ask for their recognition of a line which says we will not cross the conscience of the employer who cannot in good conscience pay for this coverage. And that's what we seek and that's what we ask for. Now, the language in sub 1 or sub 3, Roman numerals, I believe undefined integrated auxiliaries, I don't know what that covers. For example, is Catholic Charities going to be covered? Or is St. Anthony Village or St. Anthony Enterprise, which is basically a Catholic-founded, formed entity taking care of elderly people, seniors, and Alzheimer's patients. Is that going to be recognized? Or Catholic hospitals, Catholic colleges? What we're talking about is recognizing the fundamental religious values upon which these institutions were founded. If people are employed by a Catholic entity, they're not obligated to become Catholics. But they may be, as employees, expected to at least acknowledge that there are Catholic values at play in this institution. Prescriptive health care coverage is not that expensive when we get down to it. I mean, if we're talking about forcing an employer to violate conscience because of what's involved in prescriptive health care coverage.
Representative Patridge.
Well, I understand the First Amendment piece. I want to respect those pieces, but we're in a situation where we're trying to craft some particular language to create some definitional pieces, and I'm trying to get to the definitional pieces, and I appreciate what you've said, but I'm trying to get to the definitional pieces. I'm trying to get an understanding from you about what you feel needs to be covered as what's the core of this conscience clause. And if you want to take the position, and if the Archdiocese wants to take the position that it should cover everyone and it should be employers and everything else, then that's the position that you're going to take. But I mean, I want to try and work constructively towards this, and I don't feel like we're making constructive effort here.
Can you give me 30 seconds?
Yeah.
We're not in work session yet. Yeah. So we can discuss this among ourselves.
Yes, we can.
I feel like, if we were asking the Catholic employer organizations to swallow a birth control pill, that's certainly going to violate the conscience clause. But if they're a public entity and offering services to the public, generalized public, then I don't know why they shouldn't be subject to the same rules that are the same obligations that any other entity that offers similar services to the public must comply with.
Mr. Chair,
please help me.
If I could just respond to Representative Lowe. We're faced in a situation in California where in the context of House Bill 3312, which is now, as I understand, in the jurisdiction of this committee, having been sent here last night by House Health and Public Advocacy, language similar to language that was adopted in the state of California was adopted by the committee last night. That legislation has resulted in Catholic Charities of the Diocese of Sacramento suing the state of California on the basis of the constitutionality of that mandate. And it's my understanding, I'm not intimately involved in the litigation, but it's my understanding that the first ruling in that case was in favor of Catholic Charities of the Diocese of Sacramento. So we enter into a constitutional
Actually, the the diocese lost.
That's not my
And it's on appeal. That's my understanding.
That's not my understanding, Representative
of
Wall. That was not my understanding from the information sent out.
There's about eight heads nodding back there in the back. You might want to check the status of that case, Bob.
Mr. Chairman, if I can respond to Representative Lowe.
Yes, Representative Witt.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Bill Witt. Representative, the reason's fairly simple. It's the First Amendment. It's the fact that the state doesn't have the right to compel the practice that is adverse or contrary to a religious belief or religious practice. That is the purpose, and that is the reason. I mean, where does the line drawn? If there was a bill that here that said you must provide abortion as part of your health care services, it would be the same reasoning, wouldn't it? And the reasoning that I think you just expressed would apply exactly the same to that as to abortion. The bottom line is the First Amendment protects the individual relative to their religious practices and their expression of their religion. To force an employer to provide something that an employer strongly morally objects to on a religious basis is an imposition on that employer that violates the First Amendment. Mr. Chairman, I've made the Dash 11s available, and that's what I would encourage this committee to adopt. It is specific language. It carves out a conscience exemption based upon religious beliefs on the part of the entity on whose behalf of the health insurance policy is issued.
Let me ask a question. Respectfully, Representative Witt. I love the Constitution. And I'm as careful of the First Amendment as I am of the Second Amendment, and Fourth, and Third, and all of them. I try to be anyway. And I respect the strong feelings that you come to this committee with, because you've always been very consistent about this. And so I'm not trying to pick on you by asking this question. My question has to do with if you are a member of a faith that has strong feelings about what kind of services or what kind of lines you can cross or not cross, then why are you engaged in performing services related to that? For example, why are you engaged in providing hospital services at all? Why are you engaged, and then insist upon the right, of competing as a public entity with the rest of the world and providing these services, and you're holding yourself out to the public, and then you get to pick the menu of what you can and can't supply to your workers based upon your own faith when the workers that you have hired aren't required to be of your religion?
Mr. Chairman.
It would be, just a second, it would be like saying, okay, you're going to come and work for me, you don't have to be Catholic, but if you're Jewish, you have to be, you can't be circumcised. You know, it's like carving out exceptions that, based on your own belief, that you're inflicting on other people. And I don't understand how that works.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lowe, I would suggest that this bill, the way it is written, is inflicting someone else's beliefs upon us, okay, irrespective of our constitutional rights. So when we start talking about imposing beliefs upon somebody or practices upon someone against their beliefs, I would start by looking at this bill, because this bill imposes practices upon Catholics that they morally object to. So if we're going to talk about an imposition of beliefs, Representative, the imposition starts with this bill. Now, I will go back to the point of our specific reason for the Dash 11 amendments, and that is based upon the First Amendment and the rights of freedom of religion guaranteed by the Constitution of the United States. The state does not have the right to come in and impose upon anybody in terms of their free practice of religion. And that's what this bill does. We're not suggesting that employers that want to provide contraceptive coverage can't do it. They can go do it. They're free to do it right now. They can do that. What we are saying is don't impose upon employers or religious organizations as an employer. Don't impose upon them in a way that violates their beliefs or their conscience, particularly for those practices that are protected under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution.
Maybe I'm slow on the uptake, but if we were requiring the employers to swallow a contraceptive, that would be imposing. But requiring them to provide the same general service that's other similarly placed entities are required to provide to the general public, I see a difference there, and you don't?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no. What you are doing in this bill is you're requiring employers to pay for contraceptive coverage, being a practice that they morally object to based upon their religious beliefs. There's not a question of forcing someone to swallow something or not swallow something. You are forcing them to pay for it as part of a health care policy.
Questions?
Still digesting. Thank you.
Any other comments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, you asked the question why the Catholic Church was involved in providing services. I guess we could start with the Scriptures and the Gospels and the first healing ministries in the Christian era, or by the founder of our faith tradition, as I know you're well aware. That legacy has continued through 2,000 years of Catholic tradition, whether it be the Catholic presence in healthcare, which I believe has the largest private presence in healthcare delivery services in the United States, or in the delivery of social services through Catholic Charities, St. Vincent de Paul. These are ministries of the Church. These are integral to what it is to be a Catholic as we live out our faith, as we live out our values in today's world, in today's society, in the United States, in the state of Oregon, and globally. To ask, and not to ask, but in the language of the bill, to potentially mandate to organizations that have their roots in Catholic values, in the Catholic faith, and Catholic moral teaching, to ask those employers to take on the financial obligation to pay for health care services or prescription medications to which the Catholic Church is morally opposed is deeply offensive.
Well, let me put it to you this way, Bob. I respect that, and you know I do. You know I'm a firm believer in societies to assist mendicants and so forth. And you also know that I grew up as Catholic, because you remind me of that. You should have every chance you get, for which I'm grateful. But I see a difference here. If we had, you know, I would agree with you and the good Representative Witt's position 100%. If we were confining this discussion to employers, Catholic employers, who only hired Catholic workers, and then I would think that they would be able to carve this out and say, no, we don't have to supply this, and you can't make us supply this service to our people. But if you are a large employer and you are supplying, you have employees who are members of the general public who do not believe as you do, but who need these services, it seems like it isn't a violation of your faith, because you're not requiring a Catholic to do something that they don't want to do. You're simply being a good employer supplying a necessary service. That's, by the way, constitutionally mandated, apparently. Federal law says that, you know, you can't discriminate against women. It may violate Title IX to not provide this service. So I don't see how it wounds your soul to supply this to non-Catholics who might work for you. That's where I'm having trouble. I'm not trying to disrespect your religion. I'm just trying to get you to respect other people's religions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, I guess the broad general answer to your question is we respect other people's religions by hiring non-Catholics. There are any number of non-Catholics who work at the Pastoral Center of the Archdiocese of Portland who work in our Catholic schools, who work at Catholic charities, who work at Catholic hospitals. The policy that you seem to be suggesting is that all of a sudden we should erect barriers and only hire Catholics, which I think people who work for Catholic institutions may be surprised to be coming as a recommendation from a state legislator.
I'm not suggesting that at all, and you know that.
Then what's at stake here is when people go to a Catholic institution to be hired, they should not expect the Catholic Church as employer to be engaging in activities or to be paying for activities which the Catholic Church teaches and which gets great media play the Catholic Church finds morally wrong, whether it be abortion, whether it be prescriptive contraceptives, whether it be assisted suicide, etc. One usually knows the philosophy of an organization or an employer before one goes to work for that employer. Or one should know what the organizational philosophy is before one goes to work for that employer.
Bob, let me interrupt you there. In terms of, have you seen the Dash 10s?
Briefly, just a little while ago.
Not looking at above and below line 8 of the Dash 10s, lines 8 and 9. I'm just curious in terms of if that approach, because to me that was sort of, if you're carving out and you're hiring individuals and you simply say, you know, we have beliefs and therefore, you know, we're going to operate our institutions and our businesses to those beliefs, and so therefore don't expect that we are going to do that. I mean, do you have a problem in that kind of thing in terms of where this is sort of the ultimate, you just simply state up front, you're coming to work for us, so don't expect that we're going to pay for abortion, don't expect that we're going to pay for contraceptives, in terms of, because it is at odds with our religious tenets, so therefore, you know, we don't want it. I'm just curious in terms of if you could live with something like that, because that seems to be a pretty broad exemption. Where you just simply make a policy choice as an employer and say and move forward from there.
Mr. Chair, in terms of the amendments that are before this committee, which I have had just a brief opportunity to review, the only amendment that we can support is the B-11 amendment.
But I'm trying to understand. You just simply said that no one has an expectation if when you can work for an organization which is operated by the Catholic Church, and so, I mean, I'm taking you what you just simply said in terms of that this would seem to be a way of expressing that in a very affirmative way in terms of you just, and like I say, I'm not expecting you to look at, I'm looking at just the language on line 8 and 9 and take it out, because that seems to be a very broad way to address this, which simply says you just make an affirmative policy, you know, and you're done.
Mr. Chair, just having received this language, I don't feel that I'm in a position right now to comment on it other than to indicate support for the Dash 11 amendments. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Mr. Chair, if I may. Thank you. This is Cheryl Walker, Representative House District 51. I received the Dash 11s, too, after I got here.
We are under a call.
I'm sorry?
We are under a call.
Well, we are under a call in the House.
Yeah. So, and then we have another committee in this room. So.